There, where's take a look.
On that scale? Where's A over there?
Yeah, Aleph
yeah.
is the A, okay. but it's the fun thing with Hebrew is in the original Hebrew there were no vowels, just consonants.
Okay.
Okay. So, for example, the word for Yahweh in the original would be a would look like this. And so you'll have the same letter here as here. That's a yod, okay? That's the y sound for a y. This is an h sound that's called a he. This would be a, depends on who you ask, but a wow or a vav, but I prefer to call it a wow with another he. So it would be the wh or yhwh. And then you insert the vowels and you'd have Yahweh. Okay. But in the original Masoretic text, you didn't have any vowel pointings. But what they ended up doing is they would add the vowels later on underneath. So you'd have little insertions there with some placeholders, and I believe it would be the E sound there. So that's how you then would read, as a modern-day English speaker, the Hebrew language. So you have the Y with an ah sound with the H ending, so Yah, and then this is kind of silent, with a W and an eh sound and another H. So Yahweh would be the name of the divine name of God is given in Exodus chapter 3, I think it is. Okay. So just a little bit of Hebrew background, but this is the language of the Old Testament. This is what they spoke. This is the language God communicated in to his people as it was developed over time. So you do have the Aleph, Beth, Gimel, Daleth, Hey, Wow, Zion, Cheth, Tate, Yod, Kaf, Lamed, Mem, Nun, Samek, Ayin, Pei, Tsade, Kof, Resh, Sin, Sheen, Tau. Okay. Now here in the Sin and the Sheen, I believe in the original you wouldn't have the little points up there, but they are two different letters even though they look exactly the same. And this would be a way that true Jews could distinguish between the phony ones based on the pronunciation of certain words with those letters. So if you knew if you were a true Jew, you'd pronounce the word correctly. If you weren't, you'd pronounce it incorrectly based off of what you thought this letter actually was. So this letter here is, this is a S sound. This is also an S sound. This is a Sh sound. Okay? So three different letters with an S and an SH sound. Again, this really doesn't have a sound, but it's used as the place for the vowel A, or begins with A. So Adam actually begins with the Aleph. But you'd have the kind of this underneath to be the vowel sound. Yeah. So A, B, G sound, D sound, H sound, W, Z, kind of a like the he in Greek. This is a kind of a T sound. This is Y. This is a K sound. L, Lamed. This is M, N, S, kind of like Aleph. It doesn't really have its own sound. This is P. This is a TS sound, tsade. This is another K sound with a R sound, the S, the sh, and the T. Okay. Everybody got that? Test next week. Pass it. There you go. Okay. Yes, yeah, sure.
Was Abraham the first one identified as a Hebrew?
First one identified as a Hebrew. Good question. Depends on, yeah, he's the one called out from where he lived in Ur, okay, which is up in the Babylon region, to leave and then go to Canaan. So actually, yeah, he would be the father of all the nations, but he is a descendant of Noah, okay, so or of Adam even. Okay, so all of them, they have that connection. So they're all of the same lineage. Okay, and they would, Moses was the one who wrote the first five books of the Old Testament, the Pentateuch. He wrote it in the Hebrew. So this is the language, at least, that was passed down to him. It was probably some form of it that was given from Yahweh to Adam, although we don't know that for sure. Okay, but then that was passed down from generation to generation until Moses was inspired to write. And then he wrote down in the Hebrew. Okay. Any questions on Hebrew? Does it look Greek to you?
Yeah.
Does Greek look Greek to you? Yes. Yeah. All right, so Greek, you can see at least some letters that have some familiarity to you. Hebrew, you're kind of up a creek. There's really not much familiarity there at all, but Just like any language, you sit down, you try and learn it, you'll figure out some of that stuff. All right? No other questions on that. So again, Daniel written in both the Hebrew and the Aramaic, and that's because he was raised as a Hebrew, but then learned Aramaic in the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. All right. Going back to the timeline we showed last week, too, just to revisit this. Looking at the time that's pertinent to what we're looking at, we have the two kingdoms here, which is a result of the split following Solomon's handing it off to his son. So the kingdom is split into two, the northern kingdom, which comes to be known as Israel, the southern kingdom, which comes to be known as Judah. Generally speaking, the kingdom of Israel is more rebellious against the ways of God. The kingdom of Judah remains more faithful. Yet there are kings who fall away from that in Judah as well. And there are a few faithful kings in Israel, but not very many. Okay. Israel will come to an end, though, the northern kingdom, about 721, 722 BC, as the Assyrians come in and are led by King Sargon II. And he will conquer then the northern kingdom. But Jerusalem will be spared, and Judah will be spared at that time, and will exist on for another about 130 years. And God's giving them a chance to continue to be his people and to be faithful to him. But, of course, they continue to fall away, even though the prophets are sent to proclaim the message. Hezekiah is a pretty faithful king, alive in the time of Isaiah, is granted 15 extra years of life. And then Josiah follows after him, and Israel, he comes in as a pretty young king, but institutes a lot of reforms to bring the Israelites back to the true faith of the Old Testament and the sacrifice system in order to bring emphasis once again to the Messiah, who is central to Jewish or Old Testament theology. Unfortunately, that gets altered throughout Israel's history, especially following the exile. Then we get these other kings that come into place here, which aren't on my list, but Jehoiakim becomes the king here around probably in the 610 region. Jehoiakim, he's allied himself with the Egyptians, and this is when Nebuchadnezzar starts to press in, conquers the Egyptians in the Crescent Belt, I guess, the Northern Arabian area. And then Jehoiakim, of course, falls under Nebuchadnezzar. Zedekiah is put in as a puppet king before Nebuchadnezzar finally completely routs Judah, and the kingdom is no more. It remains in exile then in Babylon with the faithful Judeans who are there. Questions? Recap? All good. Okay, so about 605 BC, so before the final fall of Jerusalem, we have the initial fall begin to take place, Nebuchadnezzar's first arrival in Jerusalem, and this is where Daniel chapter 1, verse 1 picks up. So if you'll open your Bibles and have ready Daniel chapter 1, verse 1, we'll read verses 1 through 7 to start. So if someone would like to volunteer to read those verses, you can listen to somebody else other than me for a while. Go ahead, John. Thank you.
The third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judea, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judea, into his hand, the same, and with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury, his God. And place them in the treasury of his God. And the king commanded
Ashpenaz.
Ashpenaz, the chief of the eunuchs, to bring some of the people both of the royal family and of the noble, without blemish, and of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent and stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of food that the king ate, and the and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Azariah, and the tribe of Judah, out of the tribe of Judah, that's the tribe they came from. The chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belshazzar, Hananiah he called Shadrach, Mishael he called Meshach.
Yeah.
All right. The last one's a Abednego.
You don't
know that one. But I don't know what, that's Azariah, right?
Yes.
Azariah. It's called Abednego.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Let's see. Yep, we'll stop there. Good. So the first three verses are kind of the prelude into this book from Daniel. Of course, Daniel's writing this much later on, after this has all taken place.
And how old was Daniel then?
Probably around in between 79 and 89. So, at this time when this takes place, no older than 20, but no younger than 10. We don't know exactly for sure. He's not given the date of birth. But this is about 605 BC. And so if you go from 605, and the scholars pretty much, if you're going the conservative way, dates the writing of Daniel around 536 BC. This is after Cyrus takes over and the Persians are in control. And Daniel now has freedom to write at that point. So from 5 down to 37, or 36, so if you do your subtraction, that's 64 plus the 5, you're looking at 69. So actually, younger than I had said, 69 to 79 years old, when he's writing this down. So this is the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, so the southern kingdom still in play. Nearing its end, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Now, Daniel calls him king at this point, he is king when he does come and besiege Babylon. But he hasn't been king the whole time in his conquering. He's been working for his father, who was the king. And so he does become king, and he does come to Jerusalem, and he does besiege it. But what do we find here that's important in verse 2? Right away. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. What's important about this?
Usually they kill the king.
Okay. Yes. And
or take
look,
them with him.
So you look at this story from a worldly perspective. What happens?
They probably
would
take him with them as captive.
Yeah, but in general, you have one king who is the better power of his nation, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. He comes in, and he's conquering over a weaker king. Right? So he comes in, he conquers a weaker nation. What would the world view this as?
No big deal.
No big deal. Pretty normal, and even if you want to go the route of evolutionary talk, this is the survival of the fittest, right? The stronger conquering the weaker. But what does Daniel reveal as the true reason for this happening? God is in control. He's the one delivering Jehoiakim into the hands. Why is this important to recognize? Did this have to happen? From a worldly perspective, yes, but from a godly perspective, no. Why? God is king over and the God of the Israelites. So could he have intervened and saved Israel? Yes.
Sure.
He could have had them be the most triumphant nation in all the world, and yet he doesn't. Okay? So he permits these things to happen as the true God only can do. But the world sees it as a natural thing, but this is truly a godly thing. He gives Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. Daniel recognizes this. He writes this out many years after the fact. Okay, with some of the vessels of the house of God. What's important about this?
Well, they were sacred.
Okay. The house of God is another name for what?
The temple.
The temple. Okay. What might have some of those vessels have been from the house of God, the temple?
Chalices.
Could be chalices. What else is used in the house of God, the temple, the sacrifice process?
Well,
Okay. Could be the altar, parts of the altar. There's the basins, the washing basins, the collection basins for the blood. Probably some tools they use to sprinkle the blood on the people. Candles, lamps, things like that. All used for the worship of God through the sacrificial system that he instituted following the Passover way back in Moses' day. Joan?
Well, what was the worship of God?
That's the Ark of the Covenant.
And did they take
that? Don't know about that. It's not mentioned, so we don't know if that's one of the things taken or not. Yeah, it's covered in gold. It's gold-plated. It's not made of solid gold, though. Okay, but it is gold-plated. And it may have been something, but it's not mentioned here. And I'll have to look and see if it's actually still mentioned before this. Because something happens in the besieging of Judah or Jerusalem where we lose track of the ark and it's never heard of again. So my theory is, and others will say the same thing, is that it's destroyed somewhere in the destruction of the temple. Or in some other besieging that takes place. But Nebuchadnezzar takes some of these things from the house of God into his own possession. Has this happened elsewhere in Old Testament times? This is common, right? When one nation conquers over another, there's a plundering that goes on. This specifically, Daniel notes, is from the house of God. So it's actually the temple, not just from the city of Jerusalem itself. Okay, so these are holy things, sacred things. And remember what happens with the Philistines and the Ark of the Covenant? When they conquer the temple, they invade and they take the Ark of the Covenant and they have it in their town, what happens?
Well, they start getting sick.
They start getting sick. Okay? They shouldn't have had these things in their midst. They should recognize who the true God is and what he's all about. Okay, now, things like that don't necessarily happen with Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, but there are things that do take place as God's people are present in the midst of this unbelieving king. Okay, so Daniel makes it a point to note this, and this will come into play later on. And place the vessels in the treasury of his God. Nebuchadnezzar would have more than just one god, but chief among them would be Marduk. Okay, so keep that name in mind. We'll hear that come up as well. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch. What's a eunuch?
Castrated male.
Usually a castrated male, in some way prevented from having those other types of, at least being able to act on those temptations, okay, the sexual desires, so that he can be focused on his ministry to the king. Okay, where else do we hear of eunuchs in the scriptures? Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch from Acts chapter 7, 8, 9, somewhere there. Right. So, and these are prominent people, though, under the king, right? These aren't just castaways. These are actually servants of the king that have a lot of authority and power, as this man, Ashpenaz, does. His chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility. Nebuchadnezzar commands Ashpenaz to do this. So what might that process look like for Ashpenaz to fulfill this command? Okay, so here Ashpenaz is after Nebuchadnezzar's brought in the troops and they've conquered over Jerusalem. They're in control, they're in authority, and so Ashpenaz has to go through and sort who is left amongst the nobility here. Okay, who are the youths that are the best of the best?
Did he have to take ACT test?
Yeah, probably the present day equivalent, something like that. Well, and here Daniel lists the requirements here that Nebuchadnezzar had. Youth without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom. Well, youth without blemish, what would that mean?
Healthy, probably good appearance, decent looking.
Yeah, possibly a pre-Hitler idea? Mm-hmm. A master race? This isn't just Hitler's idea, but this is what is common. When one nation conquers over the other, you want to improve your nation, what are you going to do? You take the best of the best. You're going to take all the goods, all plunder all the goods, and take the best of the people. Okay? And especially, what are you going to use those people for, usually?
Procreation,
some.
Labor.
Labor, right? Education, labor, manual labor. The Israelites have this, of course, in Egypt. but they have to be of strong body and able to do that. The weaker they are, the less work they're going to be able to do, and the less benefit they'll be to the nation. Okay, so they're looking for the best of the best. Yeah, Joan?
And they're supposed to serve the king.
Yeah, serve the king. And these guys will especially be brought probably into closer proximity to the king than some of the others might. If you've seen some of the older films on the times, even around Christ, one that I saw, I think, was The Robe, where I think it's, he was a, oh, now I'm getting confused. Maybe it was Ben-Hur. I can't remember. But anyway, you have these people that are slaves that start off as slaves, but they're found to be of good body and good in strength, and so they're recruited into other service, even under the king, and they gain the trust of the king and so on, and so they rise in the ranks and so on. So this is a common thing to take place after a nation has conquered another nation. Herb.
Our original intention was our immigration policy in the United States years ago.
Okay. Was to
bring the people that can help the nation.
Okay. Yeah, and so it's not, we're not immune to that even today, right? Of course, we have some different ideas about that today as well, and maybe rightfully so. So here we have this whole process going on. Who's not mentioned yet so far, though, here? These first verses. Who? Yeah, Daniel, right? He's the star of the book, or at least the author of the book, but he's not mentioned yet. He's going to come into play, but so far Nebuchadnezzar is kind of the leader here, or the main person of the story. He commands Ashpenaz to go through this sorting process to bring both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, for labor, but also for procreation, reproduction, to make his kingdom better, right? And to endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, competent to stand in the king's palace, to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. What do you know about the Chaldeans? Anything? Who are these guys? I mean, this is basically who the Babylonians are. Okay. Ur of Chaldea. Chaldea, this is where Abraham initially is from. Chaldeans, they have a reputation of being wise, of being pretty advanced and sophisticated, even in those days. And plus, they also have, as we'll see when Daniel encounters in Nebuchadnezzar's court, who else is part of this wisdom class? What other verb? What's up? Okay. I jumped the gun. Okay, they're going to be part of that, but who else is there in this advisory pool that Nebuchadnezzar can pull from to interpret his dreams? Well, Daniel will, but before he goes to Daniel, he has his own, the Chaldeans, those who have this wisdom, this knowledge, the Magi are part of this, okay, along with these other astrologers and interpreters and things like that. Okay, so they have wisdom. Okay, but they're looking for people to add to that, competent to stand in the king's palace, so they can teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans, so to raise them up to have as part of his repertoire as the king. And as an added bonus here for these young youths, hey, maybe this exile isn't so bad. Going into this foreign land, we're being trained in all these ways, and we're given even the food of the king. Not too bad. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate, and of the wine that he drank. Don't know exactly how that worked. I don't expect the king to go hungry and able to feed all these youths that are now being educated, but they're probably eating the same things the king is eating. Just more of it's being brought in for their sake. And of the wine that he drank. Of course, no age limit on alcohol consumption in those days. That was simply a common beverage, even for youths at that time, so that was no big deal for them to give wine to drink. Plus, it's usually diluted with water anyway, at least in Israel. They were to be educated for 3 years. Huh, that's kind of interesting. Anything stand out about 3-year education?
Most of them, right, they got their high school education done in 3 instead of 4.
Right, to get that education done in 3. High school in 3 years instead of 4?
For college.
It also pops up in the New Testament with Jesus and the disciples, right? We usually talk about the 3-year ministry of Jesus. This is the 3-year training period for the disciples who will then take over the church as pastors. And so pastoral education at the seminary is 3 years in the classroom with 1 year out in a congregation. So kind of the same idea that's there. So 3 years seems to be a pretty well-rounded number, a good amount of time to give you the education you need and to develop you in the ways of that people. Okay, so they're to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. What is that? Stand before the king.
Be tested by him.
Yeah, it's not just, okay, now you're here, stand before me. It's a presentation time. Let's see, what have you learned? How have you developed? Are you really now capable to be my assistants or in my court? And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Now, why would this happen? Why would he change names from their Hebrew names to Babylonian names? Okay. Yeah, and what does this do to a conquered people?
Change their allegiance.
Okay, a change of allegiance.
Change
of a birthright, at least in their mentality, right? It'd be kind of demoralizing, wouldn't it? You don't get your own name anymore. Now you're a name of this people who's conquered over you. Imagine that. And now sometimes, you know, immigrants coming to this country, they change their names to fit in. That's one thing. But to have a nation come in and conquer you and then say, now you must have these names. Plus, what do we note about these names that Daniel and his friends have? We talked about this last week. Okay, Daniel ends with E-L, Hananiah ends with A-H, Mishael, E-L, and Azariah, A-H. These are all, A-H, and E-L are other are names for God. Okay, so these are all names rooted in promises and declarations of God. So that's something that Daniel and his friends are thankful for. This is a blessing for them to have these names. They're given other names that are not rooted in their true God. And some will argue are even rooted in the false gods of Babylon. And so again, this is not just a demoralizing thing for us in a society type way, but this is all a social way, but also a religious knock too. Okay, so no longer do you get to bear your names of your God, you must bear the names of our gods instead. How would that make you feel? Not very good, right? So yeah, it would be a challenge, especially as a younger individual, okay, in those days. Like, okay, well, maybe you just go along with it and we'll just see what happens. So this is the introduction into the book of Daniel, the first seven verses leading us into what's going on. Any questions, Thomas?
Pastor, would Cyrus was king quite a bit later, wasn't he?
Yes.
Would he restore the temple? Would those vessels have been the ones that he brought back?
I believe so. So long as they weren't destroyed, I don't think they were. Then they would be, I'm sure the Judeans who were there who recognized them would be able to start taking them back. And of course, that rebuilding is led by what? Old Testament figures. Yeah, Ezra and Nehemiah, right? They're the ones who are there in Babylon as well. I think Nehemiah stays, though, in Jerusalem or in Israel. But he's part of the process of bringing the people back and rebuilding the walls and rebuilding the temple. Okay, so yeah, they would be able to identify what these objects were and bring them back into use by the Israelite people, the Judeans. Okay, other questions? These opening verses. Okay, so what's kind of the overarching idea that's present here? We talked about God's hand in this. He delivers Jehoiakim and ultimately all of Judea into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. So he's the one who is authorizing this, right? And but he's still guiding over all of this process, but using other tools, other people to do his work. And then we'll see what that work really is and how he shows himself in other ways in this next passage. Right. Yeah, Chuck.
So I don't get it. He names him Daniel, but calls him Belteshazzar.
Yep.
Why? I don't get it. Why didn't he call him Daniel?
Who? King Nebuchadnezzar?
No.
Daniel? The writer? Yeah,
no.
Ashpenaz.
Isn't he saying that Ashpenaz did that?
Yeah, the chief of the eunuchs.
Ashpenaz called him?
Yeah, that's probably his responsibility as the chief eunuch in this process of conquering peoples. You pick out who these best are, and in the process of acclimating them to our culture here, you give them their names too. give them the right clothes to wear, give them the right food to eat, give them the names that they are to bear. Okay, no longer are you son of whatever, you are now son of whatever. Okay, I mean, that's part of the whole process. Okay, so this is just Daniel filling us in on this, but to the Babylonians in Nebuchadnezzar's court, Daniel would not be known as Daniel. He'd be known as Belteshazzar. Okay, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from there. Okay, but, of course, Daniel remembers his name. As do Azariah, Mishael, and Hananiah. Hananiah? Yeah, Hananiah.
But wouldn't the main thrust be to separate that God, you know, yeah, the name meaning God?
Yeah. Daniel? Yeah, because what's the thinking of any foreign power in those days? Well, most of those foreign powers have their own deities, right?
Right.
And if you conquer over another god, or other nation, well, what does that usually mean? Your God's superior to theirs.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Okay? And, of course, Daniel makes it a point to say, well, Judah's God has handed Judah over to this people. Now, is that a common thing in foreign thought, that your God would hand you over to some other people? It's probably a pretty absurd idea.
Right.
Okay? But Daniel picks up on that. He knows that's what's going on, okay, as he can look back throughout this history. And he makes that point. And then as a part of this process, of course, of acclimating them into a different culture, they are given different names. And Nebuchadnezzar's reason for doing that would be ownership, basically. Are my gods superior to your God? So we don't need to observe your God anymore. Okay? Plus, this is going to knock you down a few pegs. You don't get to be your own people anymore. You are now a Babylonian. Okay? Forget your past. This is your present. Okay? Good. Other questions?
Several places in Daniel, they tie the Medes and Persians together.
Mm-hmm.
But Persia seems to be the predominant
nation. Yeah, we'll get into that more as they come more into play. But there's some type of connection, fellowship that's there. Medes and Persians, yeah, they're usually lumped together. But Cyrus is the king over all of them. Okay. Because I think, I'll have to look again at the map. And from what I've read, Cyrus, as the king of Persia, has conquered over Media, and also over, actually, the region, I think it's called Lydia, okay? And there's other regions in that area that he's conquered over, but it's simply called the Persian, Median region. Okay? All right, moving on to the next section, 8 and following. Would somebody read verses 8 through 16? Thank you.
But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables.
Okay. Must have been a lot of avocados and fruits, so I can't even use that. Okay. Real quick, back to a map. Sorry. Okay. Here, just an idea of the conquering that takes place and the travel that's going on. So this is Judah down here on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean. This is Babylon Babylon's actually listed as a city there. So the distance from Jerusalem to Babylon as the crow flies is only 500 miles. It's not only, that's still a long way. Walking, of course, but to go, they wouldn't travel through here because this is all desert, wilderness, so they actually travel up and around the normal trade routes and back that way, and that's more like 900 miles. So this isn't just a short jaunt from one neighboring country to another, this is a long way. So Daniel and his cohorts have to travel with their conquered people into exile for 900 miles. And then this would take several weeks, if not months, to get there. Okay, so this is Daniel as a youth. Of course, younger, he's able to do that probably a little better. But Daniel, finally there, now in Babylon, has resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Now, why would he do this? What's at play here? How would he dishonor the Lord by eating this stuff? Okay, so what comes into play here are the Old Testament's regulations on diet for the Jews, right, for the Hebrews. So we know from the Old Testament that they're not allowed to eat pork, for sure. Any other animal that has a split hoof, right, which is the pig, and then I don't know what else falls into that category, but I think they're allowed to eat animals that chew the cud, isn't that right? I remember all the ins and outs, but there's some things they're not supposed to eat, some things they're allowed to eat. Plus, what we get into, I don't know when all this came into play, but in modern day Judaism, even the non-meat things that they're allowed to eat, Jews are only allowed to eat certain things that are called what?
Kosher.
Kosher. What does kosher mean?
It's
a prepared in a certain way by certain people.
Right.
Okay. So that somehow, I'm not sure when all that comes into play, but there's probably some aspect of that already going on in Daniel's time. So what he's thinking is, as an adherence to Yahweh God, whom he's not going to abandon, he doesn't want to eat anything that's going to defile God, or that eating that has been prepared in a way that isn't pleasing to him. Of course, you're in Babylon now. Do they know about these restrictions? Dietary laws, do they care? No. So whatever the king eats, the king eats. Okay. And later on, when Paul writes in the New Testament, he's going to say, it doesn't matter. Right? Because Peter has that vision, and everything is clean now. So people are clean, the food is clean, you're allowed to eat. There's no distinction anymore. That hasn't happened yet here, though. Okay. So the food that Daniel would have to eat in Babylon would defile him before God. He doesn't want to do that. Now, why would this youth do such a thing? How could he? He wanted to honor God. 10-year-old, 12-year-old?
Strong faith.
Okay, strong faith, and how is that possible for him? Okay, a gift of God, right? So God is working already in these youths to show his power. So he's given them, at least Daniel here, this resolve to remain true to the Old Testament, okay, to the past, to his heritage. So he will not defile himself with the king's food, wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. So what could he have done instead that would have been different? So this is interesting. It does show us a proper way of handling the situation. Joan? Okay. Could have gone on a hunger strike and not eaten anything.
I was saying he could have just flat out refused it instead of clearing it.
Right. Could have, when it comes, he could have flat out refused it. Maybe he would have even, he's young, so probably not quite at this point. I don't want to be a conquered person at all. Here I am in the place, I'm going to rebel. And maybe amass my own people and try and lash out at them. Okay, this doesn't happen. Instead, what does he do? He talks. He talks to the chief eunuch, the chief of the eunuch, and says, hey, is there any way I can get around this? Okay, allow me so that I do not defile. This is important to me as a Jew, as a Hebrew. Okay, so God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. All right, so how is this represented here? What does God give him?
Favor in the eyes.
All right, so we have here grace, right? Yeah. God is giving Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief eunuchs, like Joseph, okay? So there's connections there with Joseph in Egypt, right? And of course, you think, oh, that was so terrible. Joseph's brother sold him into slavery. What good could possibly come from that? Of course, all of that is God's work, his plan. Similar ideas going on here, too. Okay, so God gives him favor and compassion inside the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, okay, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my... So what does the chief of the eunuchs assume here with this request? Okay, so by not eating the king's food, they would actually decline in health. Worldly idea? Make sense? You eat just vegetables? Can you sustain yourself and grow actually fatter than others by just eating vegetables? I don't know. I don't think that's going to happen. If you start, I don't know, maybe they're included in there some legumes, right? The beans and the proteins and stuff like that. But from straight vegetables, there's probably not much you're going to be able to do physically that's going to make you bigger than those who are eating meats and dairy and eggs and all that kind of stuff, right? Okay. So this doesn't make a lot of sense biologically. And that's what this guy's afraid of. This isn't going to work. Why would I then risk it for myself? If the king comes in and sees you guys who are scrawny and weak, after he's commanded me to give you my food to eat, he's going to kill me because I failed. And so he's not going to risk this for them. And so he asks Daniel this. He questions him. Now, previously, this says God gave Daniel favor and compassion. Is there any of that favor and compassion shown in this initial story so far?
No.
Request? Well, maybe. But what doesn't the eunuch do outright? Which he may have had the power to do.
Well, not pick him.
Okay, maybe not pick him. Maybe even report him and have him killed, right? This guy's already rebelling and rejecting you. Okay, so he's out. Plain and simple. But God shows favor and compassion. Possibly shown there already. Okay, then Daniel says to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel. So already we have a chain of command. So the king, Daniel's not interacting with the king, and here he's not even interacting with the chief of the eunuchs. He's interacting with the steward assigned to him by the chief of the eunuchs, over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Notice Daniel is using those names here still at this point. He won't for the rest of the, or, you know, continuing on, but he does so here. And so he says to the steward, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. And let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So, putting their necks on the line. What would possibly motivate Daniel to make such a request? Okay, so spiritual guidance here, right? Had Daniel tried this before? I'm going to go on this diet just for fun, 10 days and see what happens. Oh yeah, I happen to know that this works, so I'm going to go ahead and offer this up. He doesn't know. That doesn't make any sense to anybody who has any common understanding of dietary whatever. So Daniel's being inspired by God here, giving this gift of knowledge to make this request, because otherwise Daniel wouldn't have done so. Okay, but God is working through him to make this happen. So the steward listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. So he actually listens and allows it to take place. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. Whew. Amazing. But what doesn't Daniel say here as a result, though? Well, he doesn't say told you so, yes?
Well, he didn't say what he was going to do if it was. Okay. The outcome was bad in 10 days.
Okay. The outcome, he said, well, whatever happens, it will happen. You can do with us as you please. The steward does take away their food and then gives them just the vegetables and water. But he doesn't do the same for everyone else, right? Would it work for everyone else?
Probably not.
Okay, so this isn't a dietary prescription that you in 2015 can follow to make yourself healthier and better. Okay? If you eat just vegetables and water, you're probably not going to... You'll have pretty good health, I guess. You'll get a lot of good vitamins and minerals and things like that, but you're not going to grow bigger and stronger than everybody else. That's probably pretty much a guarantee. I'm not saying you're going to be in bad health, because you're going to get a lot of the stuff you need. Okay? But you're not going to get from vegetables the food, four major food groups. You don't get really a whole lot of, well, you get some carbs. You're not going to get a lot of protein. Beer, coffee, donuts, and
ice cream.
Pizza. Four major food, yeah. Okay, so you're not going to get a lot of protein in vegetables, right? And probably not a lot of fat. But you need those according to.
That's why you eat ice cream.
Right. Which Donnie does have a little bit of, by the way. I do. That's why I eat. Okay. All right, so this is all then, what do we conclude here?
God's
working in the situation. Okay, so this isn't just, okay, God's hands off to all this. Daniel's just telling us, oh, this is background information. So you kind of know what's going on leading into the main story. This is showing God is already working here in the story. as he is apt to do. Okay. He is guiding his people, he's guiding the process, showing his power, even present in the foreign land. Okay. He's not bound to one nation. And what does this show us then too? Even though the people of Israel are conquered, does that limit his power? No. And that's kind of when you think of God and his omnipotence and his almighty nature, it's kind of laughable. You think, oh, well, yeah, it would be equivalent today if we said, oh, look at what's happening in America. And to the church in America. Really, God's power is being limited and reduced. Is that true? Earthly speaking, in a temporal way, we can see that. But God is not limited by what's happening here on earth or by earthly powers, just as we see here. So we don't have to be discouraged in that sense. Do we want to see those blessings happen for us in a temporal way? Of course. And when they're taken away, we do more. But that doesn't mean God is limitless or is limited. His power is taken away, whatever. He's still God. He's still in control. And he's allowing these things to happen for our benefit. We take joy and comfort in that. And that's one of the themes that we find here as well. Bonnie?
I'm just going to say, Daniel didn't even try to take credit for any of it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Daniel's writing about all this, and as it comes out, he doesn't broadcast, so yeah, this is God's working, but he makes it something that can be discovered in his writing. Okay, moving on from there, a few more moments here, 17 through 21, end of the chapter. Somebody read those, this is kind of, okay, Colin?
As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them, and among all of them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all of his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus.
All right, so this is kind of a conclusion of the first section of Daniel's writing. Okay, the other thing we didn't talk about, Daniel's book kind of falls nicely into its 12 chapters. The first 6 or 7 are, each chapter falls in line with each story. Okay, so at the end of chapter 1 is kind of a interlude, okay, the break time. Then we have a conclusion at the end of chapter 1. This is a summary of what's going on, what will take place. Chapter 2, new story. Still Daniel, still his friends, but it's not the, okay, and the next day this is what happened. Okay, but it's a next unit of the story. So Daniel ends his first unit here, talking about these four youths. And how is he referring to himself and the four youths here? How is he referring to himself, let's just say that? Grammatically speaking, in the...
God gave them
third person, right? So he's not saying I this, I that. He's saying Daniel, Daniel, Daniel. Okay, so in the historical part, the first 6 or 7 chapters, he's going to use the third person to talk about the story. Getting into the vision section of the book, then 8 through 12, he'll start identifying himself in the first person. So this is what he tells us about the youths. God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So he's only Daniel gets this, according to his writing. Okay, the understanding in all visions and dreams. That's pretty amazing. Right? Be able to hear a dream and be able to interpret it, and along with all these visions. So at the end of the time, the 3 years, and the king had commanded they should be brought in, chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. We don't have any interaction with him prior to that in those 3 years, but we know this is at the end of those 3 years, and so the king speaks with them. This is the evaluation time, the presentation. Let's see what you've learned, where you're at. And among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And what does this indicate? What does this mean? What is Nebuchadnezzar hopefully starting to pick up here?
What is Nebuchadnezzar hoping to pick up?
Well, what are we hoping Nebuchadnezzar starting to pick up here? He's looking at all of these other youths that are brought before him, and of these, all these youths, these four are better than the rest.
Something special
is going on there. And in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them. So he grills them, right? He questions them about lots of different stuff. What exactly, we don't know. But he finds them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. So not just better than the other youths that are just educated, but better than
everybody in his kingdom,
his council, right? So this is pretty intense.
Well, so we know that obviously they're this way because it God's plan for
yes.
them. But we can't possibly hope that King Nebuchadnezzar
no.
would think that because he has no faith or belief in it.
But even before we would expect Nebuchadnezzar to understand why this is happening, what could we expect Nebuchadnezzar to maybe start piecing together? Okay, yeah, these guys are special from this place where this God was in control. So these other kids from these other areas, not so much. Maybe there's something to these guys and this God. Okay, and this should be a preliminary warning for Nebuchadnezzar to watch out. Listen to what these men have to say. Okay. Especially as we're going to find out, Daniel chapter 3, when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do not bow down to the foreign image, and Nebuchadnezzar still throws them in the fiery furnace. Obviously, not following along in this wisdom idea. Okay. But this should, you would think, start to sink in for somebody. Okay, these guys are different. 10 times better than all my magicians and enchanters in the kingdom. That's astounding. How is this possible for these youths? Only by some type of divine intervention. And whether or not he believes in Yahweh God is irrelevant, but he should recognize this is not just, these aren't four normal guys.
Pastor, what's with these dreams? This, making sense of these dreams?
Mm-hmm.
What's with this stuff back then?
Good question. I don't know what the culture was. What I do know is it's regular enough that they have some type of system of interpretation for these things. So they've had so many dreams and so many people studying these dreams that you can actually, or they could find and go to books and say, oh, you dreamed about this? This is its correlation in the world. So this is what the enchanters would do. This is what the magi would do, the magicians. They say, okay, here's your dream. Okay, this lines up, and they'd be able to tell the king. And of course, this then, it may be something along the lines of, it would probably be more atheistic or demonic even. Okay, let's tap into the spiritual realm and get these visions so I know what the future holds for me. A lot of kings would do this, superstitious-wise, right? Like, okay, you guide me, that you have these advisors, what must I do? Okay, and how would they get that information? Well, they would either make it up or they would divine it from the spiritual realm, which... not an impossible thing to do. When we talk about seances today, we talk about tarot card reading, palm reading, all this kind of stuff. We have to be careful. We don't just dismiss it out of hand as it's fiction. Okay, there is a demonic realm that is present where these things can actually happen. It can be a scary thing.
But where it says, Daniel had understanding of all these visions and dreams.
Yes.
When the Bible says this, I always am like, okay, well, Daniel had understanding of these visions and dreams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he knows everything that these guys know about dreams, plus everything else. And we'll see that when it comes to the visions that the normal guys can't interpret, how is Daniel able to interpret them? By God's gift, right? Because God knows all these things. And God will use visions. God uses visions and dreams, too, to communicate messages and to inspire his people. Okay, but that doesn't mean that it's not happening outside of God's plan, too, or with the demonic realm, too.
So with Daniel, God would actually be using Daniel to really interpret these dreams and visions for these guys.
Right. Truth, yeah. Whereas, especially,
you could have a dream and tell me, and I could interpret it for you.
Well, yeah, but see,
I can give you quite a sell job on it.
Sure. But see, what Nebuchadnezzar could do though in that day would be, you could come up and say, oh yeah, this is what your dream means. But he would look at his sources or talk to his counselors and say, is this true? And they'd say, well, no, not based off of all these other instances in the past. So they may not be able to pinpoint it exactly, but based off of history, this has probably happened a lot, especially in those cultures. They'd have a resource system available to access that. Okay. Now, when it comes to, this is the interesting thing, with all this source and wisdom available, there are dreams then that Nebuchadnezzar has he can't interpret, or his men can't interpret. And he's left wondering, what does this mean? What do I do? Of course, then we realize that who's given him this vision, this dream, it's God. And the normal books, the normal tools are not enough to interpret it. It has to take divine intervention and God's working through a man to interpret it. Just like Joseph, right, in Egypt with the Pharaoh, and with his dreams. Yeah, Joseph in the New Testament. Yeah, and thankfully the visions of the angel, the dreams that come, don't need an interpreter at that point. But see, this happens in the Old Testament too. God will communicate to his people in visions that don't require interpretation. So, and I'd be curious, I haven't done a study on that, but in those instances where the interpreter is required, is it a vision that occurs to a believer already or not? That is, will God allow a vision to take place to a believer that needs an interpretation by somebody else? Or will he simply communicate his message directly to the believer in the vision or in the dream? Okay. I don't know. Yeah.
All these dreams and visions, he had understanding in all the visions and dreams. This would have been during the 3-year period before the king knew of him, right?
Good question.
I can't.
What he's saying, there's a 3-year period when they bring him into Babylon and they're being taught all these things. Right? And Merv is saying, is this when Daniel develops this understanding of all visions and dreams, does this happen before the end of that 3-year period? So is he able to get all these, understand all these dreams and visions before, during that time he's being educated? Right? And I don't know that for sure, and I don't even know if that's something that's been tested at that time. Okay? Because maybe it's something where, again, I don't know what the evaluation process is. Come and stand before the king. And he says, okay, now according to a dream, if you see this in the dream, what does that mean? And then Daniel would be able to say, well, based off of the studies I've had, this is what it would correlate with. And then the king would say, okay, very good. You obviously have understood that. Okay, so there's obviously that kind of education, that training that's taken place. But what the king finds is these guys are 10 times better than even their own magicians, their own resources. So it must be that this ability is given to Daniel even before the end of that 3-year time. That would be my conclusion. I could be wrong, but again, this is kind of a summary section of the first unit that Daniel's given, so timing isn't precise as it might be in the other part of the earlier part of the chapter.
Are we not to assume, though, that the king called them to come to him
after
the 3-year period?
Oh, they would be called in, and that's what the rest of the chapters will discuss. Okay, but this is simply at the end, this is the introduction to the story.
Right.
Okay, end of the 3 years takes place, the king brings him before, this is what he finds with them. Okay, Daniel, of course, knows he's been given this ability to understand all visions and dreams. The king probably doesn't know that yet. But he may have some idea as he's challenged by these dreams and his men can't handle it. So he will go to Daniel for that. Or Daniel will hear about it and he'll step in. We'll see. Okay. Anything else? All right, so major points for today. God is active in Daniel and these three young men, even in Babylon, which is not the bright territory of Israel. Okay, so God's not bound by boundaries. He's not limited by political lines or geographical lines. He's God over all. Okay? And he allows these things to happen for the benefit of his people. And that will develop more in the next chapter. Okay. All right. Joan, last thing?
Well, I think the one thing is that God
is
in control.
Yeah.
And we can control around.
Yeah.
So we have fears about what's going on. Fears about hell.
Yeah. And to put a little bit of a Lutheran spin on that, when we say God is in control, we'd say, well, that's probably a law thing, because he's in control over everything. But the gospel aspect is, he's in control over everything for our benefit. Okay? So he's using all these things, as Paul says in Romans 8:28, for the good of those who love us. Well, we might not see exactly how that works. This is the confidence that Christians have. No matter what's going on, God can and will use these things for good, for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Daniel didn't have Romans 8:28 to look to and know that. But that truth was established, I'm sure, long before Paul ever wrote it down. So that even Daniel and those faithful Jews, Hebrews, would say, God's in control. He's able to work even through these things to bring about his grace. All right, let's close with the doxology.
Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise him, all creatures here below. Praise him above, ye heavenly hosts. Praise Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Amen.
All right, read chapter 2:4 next week as we continue on. Have a good rest of the week. See you soon.